flooded the entire planet and caused terrible heroin crises all over the world, including in the United States.
You write, no person in any position of influence dared to suggest that the scourge of opiate addiction, then afflicting the poor and working class across the United States, might have resulted from the wartime narcotics bonanza.
Right. And part of that has to do with the DEA's assertion that only 1% of heroin in the United States comes from Afghanistan. This is something that we were told by the DEA during the course of the war, and which was duly repeated by many media outlets. But I go into some detail in my book about why I believe that that number was fictitious. And in fact, just as in Canada, just as in Australia, Russia, wherever you look in the world, by far the majority of heroin in the United States, I believe, came from Afghanistan. Mm.
I wanted to move over to Ukraine. You have this summit that President Trump is holding with Vladimir Putin in Alaska tomorrow. You spent a good amount of time in Ukraine. Talk about where you were, when you were there, and what the U.S. Special Forces were doing there.
I was in Ukraine at the start of the war. I was in Kyiv during the Battle of Kyiv. And at that time, we had been told that there were no U.S. military forces in Ukraine, that they had all been withdrawn on orders of President Biden before the Russian invasion. However, I was the first to report that, in fact, there were members of the Joint Special Operations Command active in Ukraine from day one, including members of the Delta Force as well as SEAL Team 6. And that reporting was subsequently confirmed by other media outlets. They may not have specified what units they came from, but certainly the presence of U.S. special operators in Ukraine has been confirmed.
So talk more about the significance of this, where they came from in the United States, what they were doing.
Well, they all come from Fort Bragg, and the conventional troops that were there in Poland to back up the Ukrainian army also came from Fort Bragg, the 82nd Airborne Division. That's an illustration of the centrality of Fort Bragg to all U.S. military operations. Now, where are they in the country of Ukraine right now? I don't know that anybody knows that. But certainly, it is concerning that we have our U.S. military personnel there in a conflict with another nuclear armed power.
I wanted to go to President Trump's relationship with the military. There's the op-ed in the New York Times today talking about how it was thought it would ultimately, interestingly, be the military that would stop Trump from using it on the ground in the United States. The headline is, we used to think the military would stand up to Trump. We were wrong. And I wanted to go back to, we've talked about the New York Times revealing a trove of confidential military interviews with the Navy SEALs who accused Chief Edward Gallagher of war crimes. He met with President Trump at Trump's private resort in Mar-a-Lago weeks after Trump overruled his own military leaders and blocked them from disciplining Gallagher, despite him being convicted of posing with a teenage corpse in a high-profile war crimes case. He was also accused of fatally stabbing the captive teenager in the neck and shooting two Iraqi civilians. But he was acquitted of premeditated murder. In the never-before-released videos, the soldiers tell Navy investigators Gallagher was toxic and freaking evil. So he was a Navy SEAL. You served in Iraq. You also report on Iraq. Talk about the significance of this pardoning, ultimately, that Trump did of Gallagher and who exactly he was and where he was found guilty of committing these crimes in Iraq.
Trump's cozying up to war criminals like Eddie Gallagher is one of the most deplorable features of his administration, and is an illustration of the incredibly deleterious effect that Trump's malignant command influence has had on the entire special operations community, because Eddie Gallagher is somebody who was turned in by his own teammates who are far from bleeding heart liberals. These are active duty Navy SEALs fighting in Mosul and Iraq, who see their chief murdering people right and left, men, women, children, unarmed people. He was caught on video about to stab that teenage ISIS fighter in the neck. His teammates wanted him gone. The Navy SEAL command wanted him gone. But Trump saw an opportunity to make guys like Eddie Gallagher part of his personal political brand. And that is, he also pardoned people like Matthew Goldstein, who was a Green Beret officer, who admitted to committing murder on live television. Other people that Trump has made part of his retinue, some of the craziest people in the special operations community. All of this has had the effect of, you know, there are people in this community who do go by a sense of ethics and who are not so criminally inclined. And the more Trump is in office and doing things like this, the fewer you have of those people and the more you have of the sort of piratical types like Eddie Gallagher staying in and rising higher in the ranks. And you see that in the kind of fallout of the domestic crime that I describe in my book.
We're talking to Seth Harp. He is the author of The Fort Bragg Cartel. It's out this week, the subtitle Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. What did you discover, Seth, about the intelligence role of Delta Force and its covert actions in countries where the U.S. is not at war?
It's really incredible how little we know about the Delta Force. I believe my book is the only sort of serious investigative look at the unit, despite the fact that it is the most elite unit in the U.S. military and has been at the forefront of all U.S. Wars since at least 2001. So Delta Force, I'd be happy to tell you anything about the unit. What should I say?
You tell us. You wrote the intelligence gathering,
you said.
Yes.
So it's interesting because a lot of people are not aware the extent to which these type of units, Delta and JSOC, which Delta is a part of JSOC, are, besides their paramilitary capacities, besides their operations doing assassinations and abductions in war zones, they also have a strong intelligence gathering capabilities, and they have troops that are overseas, that are active duty U.S. military members who are not wearing uniforms, who are not carrying IDs, who are operating under cover identities, sometimes pretending to be American businessmen, other times pretending to be State Department employees, but in fact are carrying out military operations in countries with which the United States is not at war, including things like bugging missions, other things that we don't know about. And I think what's most crucial to emphasize in this context is that, unlike the CIA, unlike other civilian intelligence agencies that are subject to congressional oversight and must report their covert actions to Congress, the military is largely exempt from that type of oversight. And so I think that's one reason why you have seen a lot of the authority over covert action shift from civilian agencies to JSOC over the last 20 years.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to go to these latest moves by Trump. I mean, that special secret directive, we're using it today to talk about what's happening at home when it comes to drug cartels. But what about, and you've reported from Mexico, what about what Trump is saying, that the Pentagon can deploy in countries like Mexico? The Mexican president said, you know, had a very fierce reaction against this, going after drug cartels there. You started talking about Fort Bragg being a place where some of the most dangerous of these cartels were actually trained.
That's right. Los Zetas were trained at Fort Bragg, at Fort Benning, and they also received training from Israeli instructors before they went rogue. Another indication or another illustration of how U.S. military intervention often stimulates drug production. What was the second part of your question, or what was the...
Well, talking about Mexico and the U.S. deploying troops there.
I mean, it's complete to the extent... In these days, with the genocide in Gaza and so many other things going on, we almost have lost sight, and it seems like nobody cares about international law. But I just want to point out the kind of the obvious, that using military force against drug traffickers, however bad you think drug traffickers are, that's a total violation of the laws of war. They're not combatants in war, they're criminals. So that's one thing. Another aspect of it is, you know, the sort of typical Trump showmanship. It's not clear to me, from having worked in Mexico as a reporter for years, that the sort of cartels that the DEA creates organization charts to illustrate and tout and purport, I don't know that those really are such coherent organizations as they might imagine. And I question whether they have the intelligence on these purported organizations where they could actually carry out military strikes on them. I don't know that they actually have the targeting intelligence for that to become a reality. But in any event, they ought to look more closely at the drug crime that's taking place in the United States and even on our own military bases.
And can you talk about the long U.S. history, military and clandestine operations and drug trafficking in Southeast Asia, for people who are not aware of what happened, as well as in Latin America, for example, the illegal funding and support of the Contras in Nicaragua and the thousands of Nicaraguans who were killed?
Sure, there is a long pedigree of this kind of thing. Covert alliances between U.S. special forces and paramilitaries and intelligence agencies and foreign forces that are implicated in the international drug trade. As you indicate, one of the first examples of that was in Laos and in Cambodia and Vietnam during that era, as well as in Central America, the case of the Nicaraguan Contras. However, I must say all of it pales in comparison with the complicity of the practically the whole of the U.S. government with heroin cartels in Afghanistan during the war there. The amount of drugs that were produced, the openness of the alliance between the United States and known drug traffickers in that country surpassed anything that we had previously seen in American history.
What most surprised you, Seth, in your research for this book? You, as a member of the military, but then stepping outside, you became a lawyer. You were an assistant attorney general in Texas, but a longtime investigative journalist around the world.
The stuff about Afghanistan, I think, was the most shocking to me because it was one country where I had not worked, and I really wasn't aware of the degree to which the U.S. client state was the entity responsible for producing most of the drugs in Afghanistan. I had been kind of snowed, like everybody else, with this narrative that it was the Taliban that was doing it. But in the course of writing the book, the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, and the Taliban in 2023 had completely eradicated all drug production from Afghanistan. So seeing the Taliban come into power and totally eliminate that massive drug-producing industry that the U.S. had not only tolerated but supported for 20 years really showed, I guess, really belied, you know, the claim until then that it was either the Taliban or it was both sides, when in fact it was really our guys that were doing it the entire time.
Do you think with this special directive, a secret directive that Trump has signed, that special forces operations in Latin America will increase under the guise of fighting cartels?
It's possible. I find that to be a very complicated prospect. So many of the drug traffickers in Latin America are military or police forces that are allied with the United States. Things are changing in Mexico and in Colombia, but historically, the biggest drug traffickers in the Americas have been, let's say, the Colombian army and right-wing paramilitaries affiliated with the Colombian military. As well as, you know, you see the same type of phenomenon in Honduras and El Salvador and also in Mexico. So when they talk about targeting these people, who exactly are they talking about?
Well, you've set us up well for our next segment. I want to thank you so much, Seth, for joining us. Seth Harp, Rolling Stone investigative reporter. His new book is just out. It's called The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. Up next, we go to Colombia to speak with Senator Ivan Cepeda about the sentencing of the former Colombian president, Alvaro Uribe, to 12 years. Stay with us.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
¿Y qué será lo que está pasando?
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
Voy entrando aquí a mi pueblo.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
Y me reciben llorando.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
Yo no sé lo que tú tienes.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
Y me sigo preguntando.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
Detrás de la cola el pato.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
Mi árbol me lo están tumbando.
¿Qué será lo que está pasando?
By the New York-based Maku sound system performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. We turn now to Colombia, where the former president, Álvaro Uribe, was recently sentenced to 12 years of house arrest after he was found guilty of witness tampering and bribery. Uribe is the first former president of Colombia to be found guilty of a crime, convicted of bribing imprisoned members of paramilitary groups to coax them into retracting damaging testimony exposing his ties to U.S.-backed right-wing paramilitary groups. Uribe was a staunch U.S. ally who ruled Colombia from 2002 to 2010. During Uribe's presidency, there were thousands of extrajudicial killings of civilians who were then purposely mislabeled as rebel fighters in what became known as the false positive scandal. The killings took place between 2004 and 2008 as the U.S.-backed Colombian military intensified its crackdown on FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. To discuss all this, Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke last week with the leftist Colombian Senator Ivan Cepeda in Bogota, who spearheaded efforts looking into Uribe's collaboration with paramilitaries. Senator Cepeda's father, the leading leftist politician Manuel Cepeda, was assassinated in 1994. One note, this interview took place before Cepeda's colleague, the Colombia Senator Miguel Uribe, no relation to the former president, died 2 months after he was shot at a campaign rally in the capital, Bogota. We spoke to Senator Ivan Cepeda last Wednesday. It's an honor to have you with us, Ivan Cepeda. If you can talk about the significance of what has happened to Uribe right now, his conviction and sentencing, and what it means for a global audience.
Bueno, gracias a Amy Goodman, a Juan Gonzalez, y a Democracy Now!
First of all, I'd like to thank Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, and Democracy Now! I would say that the significance of the what happened in the Colombian judiciary on July 28th, well, that there are two main points. First, it's the first time that a former head of state has been criminally charged, and particularly has been found guilty, has been convicted of criminal charges in Colombia.
Y en segundo lugar, que se trata de un hombre supremamente poderoso.
And second, Álvaro Uribe is a very powerful figure. He is the leading figure of the far right in Colombia, and I would say a leading figure of the far right in the Americas.
En el continente.
When he became president in 2002, he sought to impose a model that legalized the narco-paramilitary forces and that sought to leave them in positions of power.
Could you lay out some of the evidence that was presented against Uribe and talk about your personal relationship to this case?
En el año 2011, cuando yo pasé de ser...
In 2011, when I went from being a member of a human rights organization to a member of the Colombian Congress and still a human rights activist, two members of the paramilitaries gave statements in which they said that Uribe had founded a paramilitary group at one of his large ranches.
Había fundado un grupo paramilitar en una de sus grandes haciendas.
And in the Congress, I organized a debate about this and about this criminal act, and then Uribe became involved in a major criminal enterprise in which there were 20 false witnesses who were either former drug traffickers or members of the paramilitaries, 20 persons who then made false statements.
And Uribe filed a libel suit against you in 2012. Would you talk about that and how that developed?
Sí, Uribe intentó decir...
Yes, when Uribe tried to say that the paramilitary statements were slanderous, he then said that I had tried to bribe them in the form of money and legal assistance to get them to make statements against Uribe and against his brother Santiago. And then when the Supreme Court investigated the situation in 2018, they found that I did not do anything illegal, and to the contrary, they turned the situation around and began to investigate Uribe for having tried to change the statements of paramilitaries in prison, and he became the one investigated, and I became the victim.
Can you talk as well about other investigations against Uribe? For instance, the 1997 massacre of farmers by the paramilitaries when Uribe was governor of Antioquia?
Sí. Uribe tiene múltiples investigaciones, pero
Uribe has been facing many investigations. But if we talk about the 1990s, there are three main ones. This is when he was the governor of Antioquia, as you said. First was the assassination of leading human rights defender Jesus Maria Valle, who had been looking into many complaints of violations carried out when by the government when Uribe was governor.
Que se estaban cometiendo bajo el gobierno departamental de Uribe. En segundo lugar, las masacres de
Second, la Granja, the massacres of El Haro and La Granja, which were carried out by paramilitary groups in Antioquia. And third, this other matter of the formation of a paramilitary group at his hacienda, a paramilitary group known as the Bloque Metro. Now, these three investigations are all being merged together today, and it seems that they may well receive greater impetus now that this decision has come down. In my case, concerning the situation of the paramilitary groups and Uribe.
Senator Cepeda, you are sitting in your office, and behind you is, I think it's an iPad that says 6,402. Can you explain what that number is? And also tell us what happened to your father, the leading leftist politician, Manuel Cepeda.
Bueno, esa cifra es la que han establecido las
Well, that's the figure that's been established by the judicial authorities in what are poorly named the false positives. These are young people who were taken away and murdered by members of the army. Right now, that figure is 6,402, but it's presumed that there are many more. And they were accused of being terrorists and guerrillas, but they were just young people looking for work.
Y con relación a mi padre fue asesinado ya hace más de 30 años.
Now, my father, he was assassinated more than 30 years ago. Now, in the wake of a decision by the Inter-American Court, it was determined, this is the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, it was determined that he was assassinated by members of the military who carried out the operation working together with paramilitary forces. And the Colombian state has now expressed apologies in this matter.
I wanted to ask you about the U.S. role through these decades in supporting what is known as Plan Colombia, right through to now, where you have the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio denouncing Uribe's trial. Rubio said on social media, Uribe's only crime has been to tirelessly fight and defend his homeland. The weaponization of Colombia's judicial branch by radical judges has now set a worrisome precedent. It almost makes me think that they might impose more tariffs on Colombia to take him out of house arrest. But if you can comment on the U.S. role through these years, Senator Cepeda.
Bueno, sobre los años del Plan Colombia, está claramente establecido.
Regarding the years under Plan Colombia, well, it's been clearly established that during those years, Colombia saw massive human rights violations. Indeed, these were the worst figures ever for forcible displacement, disappearance, extrajudicial executions, and major growth in paramilitary activity. And this is exactly during the years that this Plan Colombia aid package was being provided, which was supposedly aimed at reducing violence.
Se suponía que esta ayuda que estaba dando el gobierno de Estados Unidos iba a contribuir a superar la violencia en Colombia. Y con relación a las declaraciones del secretario Marco Rubio.
Now, as regards what the Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said about the conviction of Uribe, I would simply subscribe to the words of Representative Jim McGovern.
Es una declaración vergonzosa. porque implica una intromisión grosera,
who has said that this is a shameful statement because it is gross meddling in Colombian sovereignty. It's really a reckless accusation against the Colombian judiciary in general and against this judge in particular, who clearly acted within the rule of law and made a decision based on judicial considerations. So I would simply repeat what President Petro said yesterday, which is that we call for respect for our national sovereignty.
Que como lo hizo ayer el presidente Petro, exigimos que se respete nuestra soberanía como nación.
Senator, it's been nearly 10 years now since the Colombian government reached peace accords with the FARC, the largest of the many guerrilla groups in Colombia over the last 60 years. What is the status of political violence in Colombia today? Are trade unions and human rights groups free to operate?
El proceso de paz y el acuerdo de paz 2016.
The peace process and the 2016 peace agreement with the FARC has represented a major historical step forward in Colombia. There was a significant reduction of violence, and in some parts of the country, very notable improvements in the human rights situation. Unfortunately, however, this has not represented an end to violence. There are still guerrilla groups, there are still drug trafficking groups, as well as paramilitary networks.
Hay organizaciones del narcotráfico, redes paramilitares que siguen operando. Y en ese sentido, el problema del narcotráfico sigue siendo un problema esencial.
So drug trafficking is still a major problem that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed in a new way, in ways that not in the way traditionally that it was addressed.
El presidente Petro tiene unos récords muy importantes con relación.
And finally, under the current Petro administration, there has been a major reduction in human rights violations by military forces. Human rights violations have reduced significantly and in some areas and at some times practically non-existent.
Significativamente y en algunos casos casi que desaparecido.
I wanted to ask you as well about the current government's stand on the Israeli war against the Palestinians, especially the genocide in Gaza. President Petro has been very outspoken on his positions. What kind of reaction has this resulted in for Colombia?
El presidente Petro, para orgullo nuestro, ha cumplido un rol de líder internacional en este campo.
President Petro, and this is something we're very proud of, has been an international leader in this respect. Not only before the latest phase of the genocide began, at which even before October 2023, President Petro had proposed an international conference to resolve the peace issue as between Israel and Palestine.
Esta fase del ataque más criminal, obviamente, pues la acción de Hamas, pero sobre todo.
And then, in the latest phase, which is to say after the action by Hamas, and particularly since the genocide by Israel against the Palestinian people, he took a very clear stand, broke relations with Israel, sought justice internationally, and has called for an immediate halt to the violence.
América Latina y el concierto internacional que han acompañado esa posición. Pero,
this is similar positions have been voiced in Latin America and internationally of support for these same stands, but the response really needs to be much clearer and much stronger, particularly from Europe, say Canada and the United States, where it has been 2 weeks so far.
Partes del planeta en la cual la reacción ha sido, hay que decirlo, débil por parte de los gobiernos.
Colombian leftist Senator Iván Cepeda speaking to us from Bogota. Former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe was recently sentenced to 12 years of house arrest after he was found guilty of witness tampering and bribery. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them. Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.